it if I stay here too long. One kiss in the dark and I'll be going. You know I hate to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Coming up next for the next hour is our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronick. I'm the host of this program, but my co-host today, equally important, is Ned Apigian. And welcome, Ned. How are you doing today?
Fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're very honored. I'm just wondering, we do have a special guest who's going to be featured. Pre-recorded.
Yeah, I remember. Still yeah. Joining us.
Mm-hmm, yep. I picked up a little cold here. I wasn't on last week. I do want to thank you and Susan Morrell for filling in for me to keep the tradition alive and the local news and views happening here.
Yes.
But I came back from a very warm climate and 30 degrees difference from Austin, Texas to Dearborn, and so I picked up a little cold. And I do try to turn the microphone off whenever I'm choking my insides out here because of a sinus drip. It's nothing like Michigan weather, folks, let me tell you. Oh, my goodness.
It's good to clear your ears out.
But just wondering, in terms of after we play this approximately 30-minute interview with a political candidate, folks, everybody knows there's an election week from Tuesday. You can vote early if you qualify as an absentee ballot type person, either over the age of 60, or you're just not going to be in town, or just can't make it on that day for some reason, like your job schedule for an 18-hour day or something. So you can see your city clerk's office, and if you are registered to vote, remember we tried to remind you to do that. If you're not registered, sorry, can't vote, have to sit it out, can't be a citizen, can't do your duty as a citizen, and you'll be stuck with whoever gets elected.
No complaints.
That's right. Can't complain if you're not part of the whole thing. In any event, Ned, you gave me the wonderful opportunity to have a free spaghetti dinner with Dearborn Heights Representative Annie Dillon, and I wound up being at the station past till about after 6:30. So
I left early, so I didn't know whether you came.
Okay,
or not.
But you have some insights as to at least the quality of the spaghetti, right? Did you get a chance to meet Representative Dillon?
Yes.
Oh, did you? Shook?
I had some invited some friends of mine.
Okay.
A couple of architects and attorneys.
Oh, great.
Which were anxious to meet him anyway.
And nothing like a free meal, huh?
Nothing like a free meal.
Of course, I assume they had a donation basket somewhere at least, right?
I guess that's up to you, right?
Well, of course. But that's a nice thing to do. Often, you know, these fundraising banquets, there's money up front they want before they let you in. And so that was cool. So we're going to talk about that and some other local issues after we feature this interview.
This was your choice. Usually you have to buy tickets beforehand. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this was by phone, folks, so understand about the technical quality of sometimes telephone calls. But listen closely. This is on this show, remember, since we have an alternative format. In other words, you listen to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, because we're not the same kinds of programming as other stations. And on our news and information shows, including Ned Apigian's Then and Now, which returns in November to the airwaves, we try to feature the candidates, especially, who were not the incumbents, perhaps who were not even a Democrat or Republican. And so today we're featuring this interview with Scotty Bowman of the Libertarian Party. And you'll find out all about him. He's running for the U.S. Senate against Carl Levin and the Republican Hugendyke.
Strange. Well, without seeing it in front of me.
He's mentioned, in fact, Scotty Bowman, of course, since he's running against him. No, Scotty Bowman, we make it very clear. Anyway, here's the interview. And so perk up your ears and listen to this interview that I just recorded yesterday with Scotty Bowman. I'm talking to Scotty Bowman right now on the telephone, and today is Thursday, October the 23rd, 2008. And Scotty Bowman is, first of all, not the famous Detroit Red Wings hockey coach, are you?
Nope.
Okay. But could get a lot of support if he just endorsed you. That would be wonderful. But what is Scotty Bowman running for as a candidate? Well, the U.S. Senate from Michigan. He's a Libertarian candidate, and in accord with the policy of WHFR to provide news and information and music, too, that the other stations don't. We want to give you an idea now what Scotty Bowman and his candidacy in the Libertarian Party is all about. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Tell us first a little bit about your own background, educational background, and political background.
Okay, well, my educational background is that I've attended both public and private schools. I went to Detroit. Waldorf was one of the private schools I went to. I'm a graduate of Grosse Pointe South High School in Grosse Pointe. Went to Western Michigan University, where I got my bachelor's with majors in physics and philosophy. And then I went to WMU again to get my physics master's, and went to Wayne State, where I got a master's in education in math and physics.
Okay, and you're currently a teacher.
Yep, I'm teaching at Wayne Community College District, at Macomb Community College, and I occasionally teach at Davenport. I taught last summer at Wayne State, taught an astronomy class, so I'm doing a lot of part-time instruction.
And I have read your bio on your website, and I'll mention that now, and we can mention it later, that we're talking to Scotty Bowman, a Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate from Michigan. His website is Bowman, that's BOMAN08.com. It says that you also had a minor in philosophy.
That's correct, which had a lot to do with my interest in the libertarian movement, is because as a person who studied philosophy, I was looking for consistency in political philosophy, and I didn't find any consistency in the major parties.
Yep, I can understand that. Even something wild and crazy called logic, too. Philosophers also deal in logic, and a lot of the systems are proposed by different philosophers are rigidly, or somewhat rigidly logical anyway, and that you don't find that very often. An awful lot of pragmatism and subjectivity in certainly the major political parties, and that is quite upsetting. You know, consistency.
Yeah.
I think Ralph Waldo Emerson said it: consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, but consistency and perseverance does allow you to accomplish a lot of good things, big projects. And so that's something that Libertarian Party, I know I saw a bumper sticker from a few years ago, the party of principle. Could you explain that a little bit? Is that the same sort of rigid logic, or at least the expectation of a consistent approach to things?
I can't speak for absolutely everybody all the time, but the libertarian philosophy that our party is founded upon is based upon certain basic principles that we can apply to a broad spectrum of life's experiences, and that includes the basic idea that we all agree to when we join the party, is we oppose the initiation of force for the purpose of social or political goals. Specifically with the phrase initiation of force is applying to is the notion of using violence as a means of first resort rather than as a means of defense from harm. And what we see in society at large, especially the kind of government that the major parties have given us, is a system wherein violence is employed on a regular basis, or the threat of violence, for policies to be enacted. Basically, you got legislation with criminal penalties, in other words, violence, for people putting certain chemicals in their body, for people possessing certain things, even for certain sex acts between consenting adults. We have laws that will take your property if you don't pay your taxes, and if you don't want to give up your property, again, it comes back to threats of violence, be it in the form of imprisonment, for instance, but if you don't want to go to prison, then it ultimately comes down to the barrel of a gun. So in that sense, we deal with a very basic principle of nonviolence, with the recognition that when people do break away from reason and choose violence, that then you often do have to use similar means to protect yourself.
I often hear, of course, supporters of the Libertarian Party talking about it's the Freedom Party. Probably more specifically would be the word that's maybe more often in the Constitution, or at least the Declaration of Independence, the word liberty, which is sort of responsible application of freedom as long as you don't hurt other people and so on. And almost all of the issues, as I understand the Libertarian Party, of our country, and really can be interpreted through that desire to increase personal liberty. Am I on the right track there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we believe in maximizing individual liberty and minimizing government intervention.
Mm-hmm.
We realize we're not going to get the ideal system right away. That's just not going to happen. And so some of these people are like, oh, you know, we scare them or something because they think, oh, gosh, how can we get by without all these things? Well, it's not going to happen that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What will happen is if you start voting libertarian, and if lots of people do, you'll start seeing a movement away from greater government control and a movement toward more individual liberty. No politicians, no matter what their promises are able to deliver everything they offer. I'm just setting a goal. I'm setting a high standard of a direction to move in. And I think one needs to really do that in order to get us going that way. It's sort of going back to my physics background a little. It's like if you got a speeding train going down a track and it's about to go off the cliff, you have to exert a whole lot of force in the opposite direction just to slow it down. It doesn't mean you want the train to even go in reverse, but just to slow it down, you got to exert a lot of force in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And philosophically, what we're talking about here is, we, you know, have a system that's basically going deeper, and I'm not going to say toward tyranny. I used to say that, a lot of us did, but since we're already there, going deeper into tyranny over time. And one needs to say, if you don't really want to just keep going deeper into tyranny, where do we want to go? And the direction is in the direction of liberty. Any compromise between the two ultimately will lead to an acceptance of tyranny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the term is always bandied about in between the Democrats and Republicans, which, of course, have been part of the problem, you might say, or certainly the problems that we've had in recent years. They're both parties were there, either one or the other in power, and we don't have don't have answers, and government is getting bigger, and government control is increasing, and. And really, we've had a system that has many, many socialist elements since the Federal Reserve and Social Security started, in the first half of the last century. So it's, that's a bugaboo that, I mean, either you like socialism or you don't. We've had it in our system to a great extent, and now more so than ever with the so-called financial buyout and nationalization to some extent. We don't know where it's going to go or how far right now. The banks, it's been approved by the Dems and the Republicans. I wanted to turn from libertarian, too, and people always say, well, why vote for a third party? Ralph Nader was the ultimate spoiler a couple years ago. It's interesting they're not bringing it up anymore. Don't even mention him. But the third parties this time around, and we're talking about the other legal candidates for president, at least. Let's just talk the presidential. In Michigan, I think there's six candidates running for president in Michigan on the ballot, representing Dems, Republicans, and four other parties. And these parties this year nationally, I think, have had a lot of support between themselves and to the public, and thanks to Ron Paul's efforts too, who ran for a Republican nomination for president and was a former libertarian presidential candidate back in the 90s, that basically they had, and I don't remember the exact date, I think it was in early September, he got most of these September presidential 10th. Candidates, September 10th, yeah, it is a famous date, I think, because I never heard of such a thing happening before, and I'm pretty old, where they collectively said, vote for any of us, but certainly the Democrats and Republicans should not be your choice. I mean, we're making an argument that, this, there's so much in common between them. They're the ones that have controlled government. They've got us into a number of situations. Now, here at WHFR, at least on the Journal show, we don't take sides, don't make candidate endorsements, but we do try to let people know what the full range of choices are. So could you just talk for a minute about that,
sure.
What it means to, let's say, vote for any of the third parties? And, of course, you hope it's libertarian. But
now, on the case you were just mentioning, it wasn't just a matter of the candidates getting together, but actually not just the three that attended, but also are all four, Bob Barr, Ralph Nader, Chuck Baldwin, and Cynthia McKinney, all agreed on four planks. And they were on foreign policy, which was essentially a non-interventionist foreign policy plank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On privacy, a pro-privacy anti-Patriot Act privacy plank. National debt, basically opposing any increase in the national debt and desire to see it paid off. And on the Federal Reserve, a desire to at least see the Federal Reserve audited and basically put out in the open, getting rid of any special immunities. That all four of those candidates agreed on those planks, and myself, Harley Mickelson of the Green Party, Mike Nicotin of the Constitution Party, which is called the Taxpayer Party in Michigan, and Doug Dern of the Natural Law Party, which is the party under which Ralph Nader is running in Michigan. Mm-hmm. All four of us have agreed to those four planks.
Okay. Well, we can talk a little bit about more of in detail about those in a moment. We are, just to remind our listeners, we're talking to Scotty Bowman, not the Red Wings hockey coach, who is the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate from Michigan in the November 4th election. Let's talk about the Ron Paul connection, because on your own website, Bowman, that's BOMAN08.com, you mentioned Ron Paul significantly, and of course he was a Republican nominee for president. So what is there in the Ron Paul connection for you?
Okay, by the way, he was also a Libertarian nominee for president in 1988. And that's when I first met him, and that's when I first voted for him. So I had kind of an opportunity to vote for him again while he was a candidate for a different party in the primaries. I got involved in his campaign because I was quite inspired by the fact, as soon as I saw him, I think the first time I saw him in the more recent election cycle was on the Colbert Report. He showed up and basically said things straightforward, and a lot of the libertarians had actually gotten kind of a little more soft selling of our message because we were concerned that maybe we needed to somehow make it sound more mainstream to draw more people in. Mm-hmm. And what I saw happening, though, was Ron Paul doing quite the opposite, just going right for the jugular on the issues and people rallying behind him. So I found that quite inspiring because, frankly, I prefer to go right to it myself.
Mm-hmm.
To see that that was actually effective, and that gained him, you know, way more supporters than the Libertarian Party had had members at any time. And so that I saw as a big opportunity for the freedom movement in general, and I got behind him and worked in Michigan as a activist for the Ron Paul campaign, and did a lot organizing my local precinct, became a precinct organizer.
Yeah, I think in terms of the principles, the typical, usual, historic principles of the Libertarian Party, Ron Paul in his run for president as a Republican, and there are some connections between Republican principles and Libertarian, but also some connection between the traditional or historic Democratic Party principles and Libertarian too, but he definitely did not like sell out when he became a Republican in terms of Libertarian principles. He's made very, very strong defense of those, and we've mentioned on my show too his book The Revolution that came out in the summer, I believe. Very short book, but certainly makes you know, Ron Paul really understands economics. I mean, he is a very well-educated person on economic principles and economic theorists. And in this book, The Revolution, he does present understandable, accessible ideas about what's wrong with our national economy, which certainly is a complicated subject. If it wasn't, I guess we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. But it's a great book, and I guess you would agree, because again, the Ron Paul Revolution is kind of this, you know, movement tremendously supported that's almost beyond the Libertarian Party too. What do you see as? Well, it's hard to say what the future will be until after the election, I guess. So let's just. Is Bob Barr, the Libertarian candidate for president, does he serve a purpose too? I mean, he's on the ballot here in Michigan. Is it a tough choice of who to vote for?
On CNN, and he's made a number of appearances there, and on Comedy Central. So he has boosted the profile of the party in some venues. But regrettably, his failure to show up at various Ron Paul events and really taking advantage of that groundswell within the freedom movement has basically neutralized much of the benefit he could have been for us.
I see.
And so as a result, I find myself having I have a large number of my supporters and volunteers being Ron Paul supporters. Really rather disappointed with Bob's failure to appear at various events, and I think a whole lot of votes that could have been going to Bob Barr are consequently going to Seth Baldwin.
But there's again, as you said, there's on these four principles, almost all of the major third parties, as they're called, seem to have agreement. Let's talk to just briefly about that. What about, or at least a libertarian stance, the income tax and the IRS? What should we do about that? Nobody likes taxes.
Okay, well, income tax and IRS, my answer on both of those is eliminate them and then replace them with more freedom. The way I say it that way is because some other folks have suggested, for instance, putting in yet another tax, a fair tax, whereas in some respects, and I actually have supported that idea on the state level just as an experiment, because I'm willing to take a chance to something on the state level. It's a little more flexible, but trying to change things on a federal level, what I would see happening is that you'd institute the so-called fair tax, and the income tax on the promise the income tax would be removed, and we'd end up with both taxes. That's what I think would happen. So I basically support the elimination of the income tax in the IRS.
Yeah.
As far as how things are paid for, basically you could spend at year 2000 level and not include the missing money that would have come in from the income tax.
Okay.
And I support a much smaller government. We could easily reduce spending down to the 2000 level.
Okay. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. Just heard a little click-clack there. It's interesting that Arkansas Governor Huckabee, Republican, was the only other Republican candidate that was speaking very positively about the fare tax. And I've read a book or two about it that explains it more in detail. And I have to say that I think it's certainly a viable plan, and it's not exclusively just libertarian. Unfortunately, a ballot proposal in Michigan, they were trying to raise enough signatures to get the fare tax just for Michigan on the ballot instead of an income tax, and that didn't happen yet. But are you in favor of at least that happening for even just
Michigan?
Yeah,
that's what I was saying. Is on the state level, I agreed that while I don't really favor either one, if the proposal directly is replacing one tax with the other at the state level, mm-hmm. I'm willing to take a chance on that.
Yeah.
When we start getting to the federal level, it's dealing with a much larger animal. It's a little less manageable. I see instead the whole thing turning into a situation where they say, oh, well, we first have to pay off the debt, so we're going to keep the income tax a little longer to take care of this. And then in the long run, what one ends up with is both taxes. And that's just been the way it goes. The income tax started as a temporary war tax. Mm-hmm. It was only supposed to be for the war. And then after the war, they were going to remove the income tax. It never, obviously, has never gone away.
Well, one of the things I liked about the fare tax provisions, whether it's Michigan or the federal government, is that initially the proposals all say that, well, we'll work out a number, an amount that is equal to the same sort of income that we're already getting to run government. But after that, the fare tax amount, the number is very much out in the open. It's not hidden. People are always aware of what it is, and then you can talk about decreasing that income if you can find ways to save money on services or cut back on illegal wars or something like that. So I've heard that going along with the fare tax proponents is that if you make that sort of government income more visible, more upfront, simpler to understand, then people can also talk about then decreasing that in a more rational way. Well, and when it goes up too, when we went into the war in Iraq, nobody talked about how we're going to pay for it. I mean, that had never been done in history. Is that, we don't have to sacrifice anything. And, it's like, oh, we've got all this extra money. Well, we didn't have any extra money. And I guess we had to borrow from China or somewhere. Well, let's move on here. It's not my show. It's your interview. You mentioned the privacy issue, the government spying, and the Patriot Act is actually not very patriotic if you look at our basic freedoms that are being stepped on there. The Federal Reserve System, that's the big economic crisis we're in. What do you think you could do as a U.S. senator? What would you support? Again, complicated issue, big issue, but some general principles you think should be remembered here?
Well, I think, first of all, the Federal Reserve System needs to be audited. Another thing we could do in fairly short time is restore the gold standard based upon that audit to see what reserves, if any, exist. What we had before is at least the situation prior to 71, where there were gold reserves. They weren't equal in value to the amount of dollars that were being printed, but there was at least a percentage that was attributable to being backed by gold. Now we don't have anything to work with there. We need to at least reestablish that kind of stability to the system, because otherwise what really is going on here is Peronomics, I call it. Basically, the economics of the Peronists in Argentina, whereby you're simply turning up the pressures every time you need more money, and all you're doing is creating a larger number of paper units, but not really increasing any value. And so instead of, for instance, raising taxes, what one ends up doing is basically borrowing to represent this large amount of money. The net result is basically decreasing the value of all those dollars people already have. Mm-hmm. So if you have a people are retired, saved their whole life, and let's say they quadrupled their savings. Meanwhile, the value of the money is 1/28 of what it was in 71. If they quadrupled their savings, they're still way behind.
Yeah, let's see here. I'm just going down my list of other issues I wanted you to talk about that we've already mentioned, of course, the foreign policy issue, that our basic government plan has been an interventionist kind of thing and not really terribly close connected to the war on the specific Al-Qaeda terrorists, except maybe hunting in caves in Pakistan or Afghanistan. You're basically, just for the record, you're in favor of getting us out of those involvements, at least in Iraq anyway, as soon as possible?
Yes, and furthermore, I'm for withdrawing the entire global empire that this country's attempted to maintain. What's happened is we're basically costing trillions of dollars a year trying to support bases all over the world, and we can't even secure our own border. Now, by accident or design, there's like Mexican troops been wandering across our border and running into custom agents and having, you know, guns drawn and all this kind of thing happening. Not that I'm concerned with an invasion from Mexico or anything of the sort. Some people have accused me of being paranoid about Mexico. I'm not. But rather, that simply being an example of how completely insecure our borders are, at the same time that we're trying to occupy all these other countries around the world and think that somehow we can control the borders in these other countries. Mm-hmm. That's basically a completely unsustainable situation. We're going in debt, losing basically the sustenance of this country, and meanwhile making enemies abroad as often as we're making friends with all these various interventions. And finally, we're propping up economic competitors by, for instance, making it so that countries that are technologically able to provide for their own defense, like the European nations and like Japan and South Korea, basically propping up their economies by making it so they don't have to handle their own military, that we're going to take care of you, got your military for you. Yeah, you guys do a little bit, but we'll do most of it. And then you can spend the rest of your efforts taking care of your economy. Meanwhile, ours suffers, and ours has to compete. That's not right.
I agree. Certainly, the border issue is just one of illegal immigration. I mean, I think there's plenty of advantages of allowing immigration into the United States, but there's they have to know English pretty well, and they have to be sure that they have a job and so on, and just needs to be official, you know, we just can't have this kind of mess at the borders, which also, not just the borders, but the open seas too. There's drug problems and illegal drugs and so on. And I know the Libertarian Party has taken platforms on that. I mean, the so-called war on drugs hasn't worked any better than the war on terror. When the war on drugs goes back about 20 years here, at 30 years almost, I guess, in Nixon's reign. You know, something has to be done on several fronts in order to secure our country. And imagine, I'm sure you have suggested in some of your campaign stops what we could use these trillions of dollars for in the United States. So, good ideas. And we hope all of our listeners consider those seriously, because it has come up. And one of my last questions may be somewhat negative, but, you know, what about the experience question about national candidates? I mean, Barack Obama has been criticized because he's never managed an organization or a state before. Sarah Palin, of course, has done some of that, but she's never dealt with national issues. She's never fought in a war, even if she can see Alaska from, see Russia from Alaska. So what about that argument about experience? How do you interpret that, or what are some substitutes, if you will?
Okay, well, first of all, as far as my experience, experienced. People may say, well, you know, I may not be experienced enough to be senator. First got to say, well, is what's your main purpose in voting for myself and other third-party candidates at this time? I'm willing to concede that I'm probably not going to win this election. So the first thing I'd say is that your U.S. Senate vote is a chance to tell politicians what kind of change you really believe in. And because in this case we have Carl Levin so far ahead in the polls, I'm even willing to say that those who in the past may have had the lesser of two evils thing going, where they're afraid that their vote for one candidate would help the other one win, don't even need to concern themselves with that. So this way, basically, it's a way of expressing what ideas you support. Now, of course, there always is this risk that I could win.
Yeah.
And so what then? Well, what I would say is myself or any other candidate who gets into office, if they need to rely on experience, what they can do is they delegate that to people who have specific experience in specific matters. That, you know, I'd consult people that have military experience on military matters, because I'm not a military person, but I expect people who are. Just as the people who are in office right now often don't know squat about science, and so they'd consult someone who knows something about science. I remember, for instance, when we had, perhaps this is a bad example, Dan Quayle in office, he didn't even realize that there wasn't breathable air and running water on Mars or something like that. I mean, that there are people who just don't, or he thought there might be life there that we didn't know yet.
And I think the Bush administration, if I can just use my own opinion here, the most recent Bush administration, the last 8 years, has been one of the most unfriendly, understanding administrations in terms of credible, verifiable scientific opinions, whether it's about the environment or, well, everything's about the environment in one way or another. But, you know, constantly keeping the EPA from doing its job, covering up the details of reports and trying to postpone factual scientific information, which can help us solve problems, or at least realistically look at the problems, from ever getting out to the public. And that's unconscionable. That's so I agree with you. I think we should ask in the experience category, who knows, let's say, more about or anything about science? Who's actually knows what chemistry, physics are all about and can understand these things and respects it?
And also, like, as far as we look at what some of the experienced people have been doing, I mean, I'm more concerned with someone's going to do than necessarily how much experience they have prior to doing it. We have people basically have sold us out with the $700 billion bailout, helping the, you know, economic elite further rip off the American people and essentially just doing their thing for them. And when I've heard people defend this, they'll say, well, we talked to the experts, and the experts have told us that the economy would crash without this. Who are the experts? The economic elites or the people working for them who are benefiting from the very bailout package they're voting on.
Well, Scotty Bowman, we've been speaking to you for the last half an hour, and it's given us a lot of good ideas. I'd like to give you a chance to sort of summarize maybe a minute or two why people should vote for you for senator. I know you've already expressed an idea that I hadn't heard before, and that was besides sending them a message, but actually there's no chance of a lesser of two evils here. I guess there is a Republican running against incumbent Senator Levin, but I don't even know what his name is. And if you know it's
Jack Hogendyke.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm helping with his name recognition.
Okay, yeah. I'm sure Republicans, no insult intended. I just hadn't heard his name before, and he does have a somewhat, you know, difficult name to remember easily. It's not Smith or Jones, not that it needs to be. So my apologies to Hogendyke. Please summarize the basic principles of why they should vote for you in order to conclude this.
Well, if you vote for either a Republican or a Democrat, it tells them that you're pleased with the economy and thrilled with the idea of strangers listening to your phone calls, reading your emails. It tells them you're happy to see billions of dollars and thousands of lives thrown away on reckless crusades. Whereas a vote for Scotty Bowman would tell Senator Levin he can't take his seat for granted. It would tell Republicans they have to do more than convince you to vote against the Democrat. And it tells both major parties that it's time to restore the liberties they've taken away and submit to the limits of the Constitution. And don't forget to visit Bowman08.com.
Yes, absolutely. That's Bowman, B-O-M-A-N, 08.com.
Right, no W.
No W. I get it. Thanks so much for being on WHFR.FM. And, of course, as we wish all the candidates, good luck to getting your message out. And everyone listening, please make your choices, good choices, and go vote. So thanks for being with us, Scotty.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was our pre-recorded interview from yesterday with Scotty Baldwin, and I do apologize with you at the last minute. We were going to get Scotty in the studio today live, but he is campaigning, as he said, all over the state, wherever the commercial media are open-minded enough, like WHFR.FM, to not cut out the legally qualified candidates on the ballot. And just remember, folks, as I think I indicated there, I'm not endorsing, WHFR cannot endorse any candidate. Our format says we should give information about the candidates and the politics that aren't being mentioned on the other commercial media, who are apparently only concerned about ratings. And if you don't know about the third-party candidates, you won't be interested, they think, and then you will tune them out. But we think all the candidates have an interesting story to tell. And in fact, Ralph Nader, Chuck Baldwin, Bob Barr, Cynthia McKinney, most of these parties for years have been saying our economic system has been heading for collapse. And especially Ron Paul, who's right now a Republican, and he was mentioned in that interview, but was a libertarian and is still espousing many libertarian points of view in his book, The Revolution, and for years has been pointing out the problems of our economic system. The Democrats and the Republicans, again, not to pick favorites here, those are the parties that got us into this, both of them. They're both responsible. I know Republicans will say it's Bill Clinton. The Democrats will say, oh, it's that deregulation that John McCain voted for. But in fact, they're both philosophically part of the economic problem and the environmental problems that we have today. Why? Because they were there. They didn't do anything about it. They didn't see it coming. So I know I'm on my soapbox here, but folks, you should try to think and read about all your choices on the ballot on November 4th. And then vote however you wish, of course. Do vote and do get friends and neighbors who have studied and read to vote and let them know they have a lot of choices. I mean, if you're very concerned about change, well, the Democrats and Republicans aren't really promising very much change. No, they're not really. I know it's a slogan for Obama for months and months. And I know Sarah Palin now especially and John McCain have been hitting hard their maverick status. Ooh, they may be Republican, but they're not like George Bush. And that will change the Republican Party. Well, why didn't John McCain do that while he was there all those years? Okay? He has now gotten back to positions that are basically not in favor of some of the change he was 4 years ago in terms of border security, in terms of the environment and campaign financing. He's not for those things anymore. He's not really for any change, except he says he's a maverick, but he doesn't really have programs that show that. So if you like John McCain, fine. If you like Barack Obama, fine. But don't think that where they're coming from will result in anything different, but more of the same, because there's no evidence to prove that. Whereas Ron Paul was right about the coming crisis, Chuck Baldwin and his Constitution Party was right, Ralph Nader was especially right and has been right for decades. Okay, I'm going to conclude this with saying that if you want to know more, especially about Ralph Nader and Chuck Baldwin, C-SPAN put together a debate. C-SPAN, okay, a nonprofit company that tries on cable television to give you the whole story and God bless them. There's two channels, C-SPAN, the basic channel, and C-SPAN 2. And Nader and Baldwin debated last night at 9 p.m. on C-SPAN 2. But you can go to CSPN.com, their website, and you will find that whole show, that hour-and-a-half show of Ralph Nader and Chuck Baldwin debating on all these same issues. Now, why weren't they included with Obama and McCain? Well, it's because the debates were organized by a committee, by an organization that was set up by the Democrats and Republicans and guided by the Republicans and the Democrats. You think that they would give the other parties a chance? Of course they wouldn't. That is such a corrupt way to do debates. And the major commercial news media have only supported that. So if you want to see the Nader, Ralph Nader, Chuck Baldwin, who's representing the Constitution Party, debate, go to CSPN.com and look for the program from last night. Well, we have Ned Apigian, of course, is here in the studio with me, too, as my co-host today. And Ned has a major concern. It is very local, even though it's also national and international in scope, about the GM Chrysler proposed merger. And your thoughts, Ned?
Well, can you imagine the impact of having, instead of the big three, we got the little two? These things are so frightening that if you had 200,000 production workers working in three companies and you join two of them, guess what? You're not going to have 200,000 production workers. Just like you're not going to have three presidents, you're going to have one. It works its way all the way down.
If it happens, it's not going to be helping the people of the United States of America.
That's for sure.
There's going to be many, many layoffs. The companies will be much smaller. GM is, I think, desperate for Chrysler's $25 billion of cash, which for some reason Cerberus has not spent on improving the company. Okay, they didn't have to, and they've got this big pot of money, and of course so does GM and Ford, but they're burning up their money every month so fast that they'll be out of reserves, out of cash reserves, in 6 months to 12 months, unless they can turn something around. GM is in a lot of trouble financially now because, you know, investors are running scared. GM has this alternative energy car that might entice some people in 2010, the Chevy Volt. I've seen it, and I'm not too impressed, to tell you the truth, but it's something. Ford doesn't have anything electric. They've got pretty, weak hybrids compared to what Toyota have, and even Toyota in their Prius hybrid is going to be all electric. There'll be an all electric version in 2010, and I think everything is going that way. I mean, efficient electrics are the way to go in the future. Toyota has all these small cars. Ford is hoping by 2010 or 2011 to bring over their British Ford Focus line, which is so much better than the U.S. Ford Focus line. Why? Because England and Europe demanded better, more fuel-efficient cars for years.
Well, they just introduced the new car at the Paris Auto Show that they say in the papers is very exciting. I think it's not the Festiva. That they used to have.
Right.
And it's engineered in Europe.
Yeah, it's been made in Spain and engineered in Europe for years. It was a little too small, and nobody wanted fuel-efficient cars in the U.S., but it was an excellent, I'd call it a subcompact. Okay, your mic is off. So Ned has a cold, too. There, it's back on.
Yeah, that's okay.
So, no,
choke a little somewhere.
The Festiva here has been re-engineered and is going to be reintroduced back. So Ford has this plan. If they can hang on, they've got some really good cars, but they're going to have to, these really good small cars, more fuel-efficient cars, won't happen until Toyota is already got a lion's share of the market in 2010.
Well, what about the $25 billion there?
From Chrysler?
No, the $25 billion the government gave.
Well, only for alternative fuel. That's a drop in the bucket. I mean, look at the $700 billion financial bailout. $25 billion will hardly help any one of these major three U.S. remaining companies to get going on alternative energy. So
it's something. But if Chrysler disappears, who gets their share of the
I don't know. I really don't know. I know it's been approved, and And who knows where that's going.
But here's an interesting...
It just doesn't look good, you know.
Here's an interesting thing in today's Free Press. Today's Friday.
Okay.
This is shocking. Daimler, who bought Chrysler for $36 billion and sold it to Cerberus for $6
billion, yep.
Today says Chrysler's not worth anything. Minority partner values at in stake is the company's at $0. Here's what it says. As Daimler AG sees it, Chrysler is worth nothing. The German automaker has depreciated its stake in Chrysler to zero from $268 million at the end of June.
Yeah.
The company said Thursday. A little over a year ago, the company valued it as 19.9% of the stake in Chrysler.
To make it simple, we're not auto analysts here, but to make it, or economic geniuses, but to make it simple, you know, Chrysler has lost 25% of market share of the market share it had last year at this time.
Mm.
So its sales are dropping faster than GM's and Ford's. And even though it has some symbolic brands and interesting concepts, like still they're considered to have the best minivans and they're considered to have the best four-wheel drive vehicles, some of the Jeeps anyway, that's not enough to keep a whole company going. I mean, they've got the Chrysler brand and the Dodge brand. A lot of them are overlapping types of cars. You know, Dodge Nitro is the same thing as a Jeep Liberty with a little bit different bodywork. So that's really not efficient. That's really stupid, except they have some Dodge-only dealers that exist that want their own, you know, chance to get a share of that kind of products. And they got some. They should have combined Chrysler and Dodge years ago.
Well, you know what the people that are interested in Chrysler, especially Nissan, they're interested in their truck capacity.
Right. And as a publicity thing, about a month or so ago, Chrysler, that is Cerberus Chrysler, Chrysler Dodge, showed four new electric cars, including an all-electric Jeep. Right. Today's paper said they're going to be lost. Well, that's right, because they have not developed them. They've shown them. They think they could do them. They haven't put any money into R&D for them yet to make them a reality. And they were telling people, oh, we can have it out by 2010. Of course they can't. Unless they put tons of resources towards it, which even with their $25 billion of cash and whatever their share of the $25 billion from the government for alternative energy R&D, they still can't do it, really. So it doesn't look good for them, and it doesn't look good. But the problem overall, folks, is not just the auto industry and how...
it's symptomatic of a bigger problem.
Unintelligent the leaders of GM, Ford, and Chrysler have been over the years about the future of automobiles and energy. It's the whole economic crisis in the U.S. and the whole world. We're bringing the world down with us here. So we need some really good national leadership that has some really good new ideas. And whoever gets elected, let's hope they change directions and really meet the problem with good solutions. Okay, we got to move on to a couple local stories, but thank you for bringing our attention to that, Ned. I'm sure it's a concern of all of the automotive-connected Detroit area.
The Michigan economy again.
Yeah. If there's a lot more layoffs at Chrysler, or if Chrysler goes totally under as it's folded into GM, if that happens, it won't be good. Okay, Dearborn has some pretty bad roads. Michigan Avenue. Who controls fixing those? The state of Michigan.
And it's a state road, so.
Times Herald from Wednesday. Where is that?
The Times Herald from Wednesday. I think we have.
Where's my Wednesday Times Herald?
What I have is our Proposal 1 issue from the Times Herald, which is interesting, but maybe we can get into that while we're looking for the.
Well, I'll just summarize it, folks. If you look at the Times Herald, the Dearborn Times Herald from Wednesday, October 22nd, it talks about these bad roads in Dearborn. And in fact, Mayor O'Reilly's really upset. Apparently, Dearborn has, very bad roads as compared with other communities in Michigan. We're right up there at the top for roads that aren't repaired, and it's a state responsibility on things like Michigan Avenue. And he's very upset that Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, the state had come in and did some patching. Well, the patching's really bad. It was a bad, bad job. And so we still have bad roads, and it's the state's fault. Of course, the state is not exactly in a good economic
flushed
situation. So the city is putting a lot of pressure on. I thought I saw somewhere that they're going to even try to sue the state in terms of trying to get that that together. But that is a major crisis. It's not the fault of Dearborn's city government. Doesn't help with the redevelopment of West Dearborn, though, if a lot of those businesses are being avoided, not only because of paid parking, but because of bad roads.
Well, if you want to feel good, just drive through Redford and you'll feel a lot better.
The city, however, in the same Times Herald from Wednesday that I can't find my copy of to look at directly, however, there's a story about the wireless internet is really free wireless internet in businesses in West Dearborn has been very successful. Apparently, a lot of people like it. Since in Starbucks, even, who were one of the first companies to offer free wireless internet for its customers about a year or two ago, said, no, you got to pay AT&T if you want it. And a lot of people wouldn't want to do that.
Get one of those cards.
Yeah, or just subscribe and pay. And I checked into this at Starbucks in Austin, Texas, where it's the same policy for Starbucks. Cost you $20 a month for wireless internet with AT&T, and either you get one of those cards to put in your laptop, or you just sit with your laptop and your username and logon password in a Starbucks. But it's still $20 a month. Well, it can be free in Starbucks if the city has their system throughout East Dearborn businesses as well as West Dearborn.
Of course, go to Panera Bread. It's still free there.
Of course, yours truly has pointed out to Mayor Guido and Mayor O'Reilly for $2 million only, one-time fee, they could have a system set up and maybe some maintenance money from year to year, but a system set up of wireless internet for everybody in Dearborn, including in your private homes, not just the businesses.
Why doesn't the
city and the city council do that for the whole city? It's because they'll lose a little money of the kickbacks from the cable television companies.
They'll lose
because the cable companies will have people stopping to pay the extra money for internet. Well, it's wired internet, which is good. But people will say, well, wireless internet, if they've got the laptop or whatever that can do it, it's free. And as a service to the city should forget about that little 3% kickback from those extra funds and do it once for all, not just the businesses, but for all the people. Okay, that's my opinion. You know, on this show, we have a lot of opinions. We got to say once before the hour ends, and we've only got 4 minutes, Ned, and faithful listeners, that the opinions expressed here on this show are not necessarily those of anyone at Henry Ford Community College, faculty, staff, students, administration, or board of trustees. Nonetheless, what do you think?
Us crazy volunteers.
Yeah. I want to thank the Times Herald also from Wednesday, the 10th, 1022 edition.
Yes,
they have taken a statement, and I hope next week so as does the press guide, on who they think and what they think is best to vote for in this big election. Because why? Because the newspapers have the reporters. They've got their fingers in the pie, if you will. They know behind the scenes, even though they won't say some of the stuff, who is good and who's bad. Now, it's only their opinions, but they're very educated opinions. And they say vote yes on Proposition 1, which is stem cell research in Michigan. Okay.
Here is the Jackson Citizens Patriot. I guess that's a reprint.
Yeah, but they agree, or they wouldn't reprint it.
Absolutely.
Proposition 1 stem cell research, their opinion is, it's not killing of babies, okay? It's the embryos that would normally be thrown away anyway. They're not viable at all. And I know there's all these scare things about Tuskegee African-American airmen on television, some really laughable things. Detroit Today with Craig Folly. You can listen online at WDET.org to the show of Detroit Today, where a medical doctor from Wayne State pointed out that it's a bunch of lies against this. You know, somebody asked me, and I already put in my absentee ballot, and I'm not saying you should do what I did on this, but I thought, and I'm not even tell you what I did. I'm not even going to tell you. So they said, well, let's vote like Kornick did. But I voted already on Proposition 1.
Me too.
And I was thinking that stem cell research Do it for Chris Reeves. Do it for the Superman, the guy who played Superman in the first big feature in recent years, who had the terrible injury that made him a quadriplegic, that gave him no control of anything below his neck. Stem cell research has the possibility, not now, but it will be the answer to regenerate spinal cord injuries and make these people whole again. I think if you agree with Proposition 1, and I don't think they mention it in that editorial.
Yeah, there. Actually they do. Okay. They get into the marijuana issue and the same thing, which is not...
Well, I don't. They don't take a position on that, do they, in that editorial? I
didn't read that. On the stem cell?
No, on the medical marijuana issue.
Yeah. You want me to read it? We got time.
Oh, wait a minute. Stem cell is Proposition 2.
Yes.
I'm sorry. And I forget it, folks. But Proposition 1, they're in favor of medical marijuana proposal. That's it. They haven't taken a stem cell position yet. We'll wait to see if either they or Dearborn Tescott.
Yeah, when you mention that, I'm reading marijuana. Well,
that's why you're here, Ned, and thanks so much. We got to move on, folks. It is 2 o'clock. It's time for me to say this is WHFR Dearborn, and it's time to introduce the Highway 61 show, Local Blues, the best in blues with Joanne Korchinska, which we hope will be starting up almost immediately. Here's their theme song. Thanks for listening to WHFR.FM. Tell everybody, vote a week from Tuesday. If you are registered, make your best choices, find out about the issues and the candidates, and vote. We'll be still here next Friday to give you some more background information to challenge you in this election.
Vote early and vote often.
There you go. So it's time for Highway 61 with Joanne Korchinska.